Well, as promised, we're going to spend the first part of Issues Etc. today talking about what happened yesterday in the U.S. Senate. Yesterday, the Senate failed to pass with a proper majority. It was a majority, very slim, but with the required majority, the marriage protection amendment that would have outlawed gay marriage in the United States. It was expected not to pass. It lived up to its expectations. We'll be hearing an ABC News piece here in just a moment, kind of summarizing the news on it, and then getting the reaction to the failure of that amendment in the Senate yesterday from Dr. Robert George, professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University, member of the President's Council on Bioethics, and editor of a new book called The Meaning of Marriage, Family, State, Market, and Morals. That'll take the better part of the first half and probably into the second half of this first hour, and then it's open lines for your questions and your comments. I'd like your reaction to what happened in the Senate yesterday. And as time permits, we're going to hear Pat Robertson again. Every once in a while, you got to go to Pat Robertson. It's a shame it's Thursday, because this would have made a great soundbite of the week. But we're not doing soundbite of the week today. Maybe next, no, not next week either. We're doing our top five issues, et cetera, guests next week. It'll have to wait. Pat Robertson claims through a daily dose of what he calls Pat Robertson's age-defying shake. Have you heard about this? Sure you have. He claims to be able to leg press not only 1,000 pounds. In fact, we've got video. We'll play it for you with a little bit of commentary from his website of him leg pressing 1,000 pounds. 10 reps he does. His form isn't great, but he does get it up, get the 1,000 pounds up the press 10 times consecutively. And that's after working up from like 450 pounds. He claims not only to be able to do that, but from a daily dose of his age-defying shake, to have leg-pressed 2,000 pounds at least once, and we'll hear from Pat Robertson himself on that, during audio open lines in the second part of this first hour of Issues Etc. It's coming up in just about a half hour after our conversation with Dr. Robert George. In the second hour of the program, Dr. Robert Benny joins us. He's author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. We'll talk about the Christian's place in the world and what a Reformation ethic looks like. Right after that, Pastor Joel Brondos will be our guest. We'll revisit the subject of classical education. He's headmaster of St. Paul Lutheran School in Brookfield, Illinois. In the third hour of the program, as promised, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is going to join us. Yesterday, we had a conversation with John Dominic Crossan about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, an event that he denies happened literally, although he says it did happen really. And that's one of the first issues we'll deal with as we get Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's reaction to our conversation with Dominic Crossan. That will round off today's Issues Etc. Let me remind you before we get started here that you've got 90 minutes today to vote in our Issues Etc. People's Choice Awards. You do that by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click Listen Online. That will take you to the place where we have a list of guests for you to choose from, and you vote for five. Even though you vote only once, you vote for five by emailing us at the link provided right there, issuesetc.org. Click Listen Online, and you'll find that list of guests you can choose from, and you get to participate in our Issues Etc. People's Choice Award. Each one of those top five guests that you choose will be featured next week. Each one of them gets their own day on Issues Etc. And we'll just count up. Is that right? We'll count up from 5th, 4th, 3rd, 2nd, and then on Friday next week, you'll get to find out who you voted to be our top Issues Etc. guest. The Senate failed to pass the Marriage Protection Amendment yesterday. For more on this, first let's hear this report from ABC News.
The Senate wrapped up 3 days of debate on the controversial issue of gay marriage. Conservatives want to amend the U.S. Constitution to ban same-sex marriage. They point out that while 45 of 50 states have passed legislation to define marriage as only between a man and a woman, judges have often overturned those laws.
If we fail to redefine marriage, the court will not hesitate to do it for us.
Supporters also say the amendment would make clear the importance of traditional families.
And it's not that you can't raise good children in a single-parent household. You can, and many struggle heroically to do so. Yet we know from all the data the best place is between a mother and a father.
But Democrats call debate on the issue a waste of time.
The Republican majority believes that if they can bring these issues, which fire up their political base, to the floor, that they will have better luck in the November election.
And in the end, the effort failed.
The yeas are 49, the nays are 48. Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn, not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
But supporters say they will continue to push for the amendment, saying marriage is under attack. The House plans a vote on the amendment next month. An earlier effort there also failed. Pam Coulter, ABC News.
All right, there's a story from ABC News on the failure of the Senate to pass the Marriage Protection Amendment. Earlier today, we had a great privilege to talk with Dr. Robert George and get his reaction to the failure in the Senate yesterday of this amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Dr. Robert George is professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University, a member of the President's Council on Bioethics, and he has edited a new book titled The Meaning of Marriage, Family, State, Markets, and Morals. In our conversation with him earlier today, we began by getting his general reaction to the fact that the marriage amendment seems to have gone down in the Senate.
Well, I was disappointed. The Senate is not backing up the will of the American people on this. You know, every time the question of conjugal marriage, that is, marriage understood as the union of a man and a woman, has been put to a vote by the people of the country, it's passed overwhelmingly. That's been true in state after state after state, even the most liberal and secular states. California, for example, passed it by more than 55%. Ditto for Oregon, which is the most secularized state in the United States. In some states, it's passed as it did yesterday, or the day before yesterday, I should say, in Alabama, by 81%, an 81-19% margin. So the United States Senate just doesn't seem to understand where the American people are on this, and the people are just going to have to make their views clearer to members of the United States Senate and to the political class generally.
And some might say, and we talked to people when this was still being debated on the floor of the Senate, that its chances of passage were very slim indeed, if realistic at all. Why stand behind an amendment that, at least in its Senate phase, had very little chance of passage?
Well, we just have to keep coming back time and time again until we do pass it. And the reason is very clear, and it's that there's a threat to marriage today, to the conjugal conception of marriage, the historic understanding of marriage, not only in our own nation but in the whole of our civilization, from the courts. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, citing a United States Supreme Court precedent called Lawrence versus Texas, which had to do with the invalidation of a Texas sodomy law, overturned Massachusetts' conjugal marriage statute and imposed same-sex marriage on the people of that state by a simple vote of 4-3. Four lawyers decided to overturn the civilizational understanding of marriage in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I suspect it will happen soon here in my home state of New Jersey, where a case is pending. It could happen in Washington State shortly after that, and it could happen at the federal level. The judges have liberal judges have made their intentions very clear on this. A litigation strategy is being pursued by activist groups who want to alter the definition of marriage to include same-sex couples, and in their more advanced incarnations to legalize polygamy and polyamory, which is group marriage, the sexual union of more than two people. So with all of this very clear, right out there for anybody to see, it's necessary for us to do whatever we can, and take however long it takes, to amend the Constitution to protect the institution of marriage. The Constitution will be amended one way or another. The question is, will it be amended by judicial fiat, as it was in Massachusetts, by four justices, or will it be amended by the normal and constitutionally prescribed process of the people, acting through their elected representatives in the first instance in the Congress, and then with ratification by the state legislatures.
Is that the real more systemic problem here, of which perhaps the gay marriage issue is but a symptom, a big symptom, but a symptom, and that is the tendency for that judicial fiat to hold sway state by state, the activist judiciary? And if so, what do we do about that problem?
Well, there's no question that the problem of judicial usurpation of democratic legislative authority, that is the power of the people acting either on their own, as they do through referenda and initiative, or through their elected representatives in the state legislatures and the Congress, the problem of judicial usurpation of democratic power is a longstanding problem. It's a very serious problem. It's a problem for American democracy generally, going beyond any particular issue, whether it is abortion or marriage or what have you. It's not a new problem. It's a problem that has manifested itself throughout American history. It was the judiciary who protected the institution of slavery against the will of the people in the Dred Scott decision back in the 1850s, a decision that was meant to take the issue of slavery out of politics and instead contributed to the conditions that made civil war inevitable. It was evident judicial usurpation again in the early part of the 20th century when activist judges, this time on the conservative side rather than the liberal side, invalidated worker protection and social welfare legislation without any constitutional warrant, imposing on the people of the United States limitations on their democratic authority that the Constitution itself didn't provide. And now in the modern period, we find it very much on the left, with judges without any constitutional warrant, no basis in the text, logic, structure, original understanding of the Constitution, invalidating laws protecting the sanctity of human life, of the unborn, of the newly born, and invalidating the conjugal marriage statutes. Now, the only way, in my judgment, various things have been proposed, but in my judgment, the only way that we're going to persuade the judiciary to back off here is by sending them a stinging rebuke. And there's no issue better than the issue of conjugal marriage, which Americans are fundamentally in agreement with. There's no issue better than the issue of conjugal marriage with which to send them that signal. And we can do it by amending the Constitution to protect that institution against their incursions.
So that stinging rebuke really needs to be that ultimate statement that the populace can make in the U.S., and that is to change the Constitution.
Look, the first words of the Constitution, the first three words are, we the people. The Constitution does not belong to the judiciary. It doesn't belong to the political class. They didn't establish it. It's we the people. It's our Constitution. And where the judges, who are meant to be its guardians, step out of line and become the enemies of the Constitution, where they usurp authority, where they aggrandize themselves, where they abuse the constitutional trust placed in them, then it finally falls to we the people to take control of the situation and to restore the constitutional balance of powers, the constitutional role of the judiciary, and the integrity of the Constitution itself.
Turning then to that particular symptom of the day, same-sex marriage, what is the strongest argument that you think can be made against same-sex marriage, since in kind of the popular debate that's taking place, the proponents of same-sex marriage seem to kind of oddly assume the right to same-sex marriage in spite of the fact that it is found nowhere? What's the best argument against it?
Well, there are a whole lot of arguments, but there are two that really deserve particular attention, and that is that men and women are not interchangeable. They're not interchangeable as spouses, and they're not interchangeable as moms and dads. If all that mattered was having two parents in the house, where more hands are better than less, then we would be even better off having three parents in the house or five parents in the house. So polygamy and polyamory would become virtuous enterprises rather than the bad things we know them to be. So what this makes clear is that children really need a mom and a dad, because the influences, the paternal influences and the maternal influences are not identical. Dads bring certain strengths that they tend to have uniquely to them, to the parenting enterprise. Moms bring certain strengths. Now, of course, we all know that not every case is an ideal case. Not every case can a child be raised with both a mom and a dad. Sometimes, tragically, one parent will die. Sometimes, tragically, one parent will leave a child's life, leave the marriage, leave the family, leave the child's life. And many, many single parents are doing their best, and some doing a wonderful job in rearing children in those circumstances. But it's not the ideal, and it shouldn't be the norm. And what the law should promote and uphold is the ideal of marriage, understood as a relationship that's fundamental social value is in the rearing of children, where both moms and dads are important parts of the picture. Neither sex is expendable. Neither can be substituted for. Then the second argument, Todd, that is really worth keeping in mind, and it's it points right at the Achilles heel of the same-sex marriage argument. And it's very important that people understand this. And that is to remove the conjugal conception of marriage from our laws simply is to remove any impediment in principle, any principled basis for rejecting any form of consensual relations among any number of people as the basis of marriage and family life. So, for example, we would have nothing but a Maginot line of sentiment to distinguish marriage understood as a relation of two people of the same sex from marriage understood as embracing polygamy or marriage understood as embracing polyamory, marriages among three or five or seven people who are in sexual relationship altogether. And who would then make the same claims to have the status of a family for child-rearing purposes as any other set of arrangements. Now, that's not merely a slippery slope argument. I mean, I think we would find ourselves on the slippery slope, but it's not merely a slippery slope argument. It's an argument about the principal basis of what it is we're to count as a marriage. It's an argument that shows, by its very logic, that same-sex relations simply do not fulfill what marriage is meant to do. Marriage is inherently, intrinsically, a relation of bringing together man and woman as husband and wife in a circumstance that is uniquely suited to the rearing of children, where their specific and unique contributions can be made to make things go as well as possible for the children born to them.
We're talking about the Senate's failure to pass the Marriage Protection Amendment. Dr. Robert George is our guest. He's professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University, member of the President's Council on Bioethics, and editor of the new book, The Meaning of Marriage, Family, State, Market, and Morals. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. So where do so-called same-sex unions or civil unions fit into this picture, Dr. George?
Well, I don't myself favor any scheme of civil unions or same-sex unions. I think that anything that tends to devalue the currency of marriage will damage the institution of marriages, creating so-called faux marriages or pseudo marriages. But if state legislatures are to go down the line of allowing the redistribution of the benefits or privileges or immunities or rights or responsibilities of marriage, if they are to do that, then I think it's very important that the benefits, privileges, immunities, rights connected with marriage not be predicated on the assumption by law and government that there is a sexual relationship between the parties. So if civil unions or domestic partnership schemes are to be put into place, and I again want to stress that I do not think they are a good idea, then they should not be the kinds of arrangements that are meant to encourage sexual relationships outside of the marital context. Rather, they should be open and available to any two people, including people who are not in a sexual relationship or are not prepared to attest that they're in a sexual relationship and who could not, as a matter of law, be in a sexual relationship. If the goal, Todd, of civil unions or domestic partnerships is to make certain benefits available to people who are sharing domestic arrangements and who are caring for each other, then there's absolutely no reason why people who are not in a sexual relationship and cannot lawfully be in a sexual relationship, like two elderly sisters, perhaps widowed, who are living together and taking care of each other, there's no reason they should be excluded from the opportunity to have those benefits. If we're worried about making sure that people have hospital visitation privileges to their friends, well, two widowed sisters need that too. If we're worried about insurance benefits, well, two widowed sisters need that too. And this way, the law would not be throwing the mantle of approval over any sort of sexual relationship outside the marital context. It would simply be abstracting from that. If two people happen to be in a sexual relationship outside of marriage, that wouldn't disqualify them, but it wouldn't give them a unique eligibility either. The law would simply be blind toward the question of any sexual relationship at all. It wouldn't take cognizance of whether people are in one or not in one, whether they are permitted to be in one, or whether the law excludes them from being in one. So I think that's the best we can do when it comes to that question.
A critique I heard very recently of the proponents of the Marriage Protection Amendment was that, look, social conservatives, when it comes to issues like abortion, want to see the issue kept in the states and states' rights to deal with the abortion issue upheld, that is, to overturn Roe v. Wade and let abortion go back to the individual states. But, oddly, said the critiquer, when it comes to the issue of same-sex marriage, they want to push it up to the federal level and get a constitutional amendment and not allow the states to work this out on their own, as they seem to be doing so far. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'd begin the response by saying this. I mean, all too often, people who are critical of social conservatives think that social conservatives are hicks and fools and rubes and country bumpkins. That criticism shows that they must really think that social conservatives are hicks and rubes and country bumpkins, to think that they would fall for an argument like that or be moved by it at all. Social conservatives are well aware that they did not start the fight over marriage or the attempt to nationalize the issue and take it away from the states. It has been the pro-same-sex marriage, pro-sexual liberationist elements in the country who very deliberately, and I have to admire the skill with which they've done it, have taken the issue into the courts with a view to nationalizing it, to creating a national standard of same-sex marriage by invalidating state marriage laws as contrary to their conception of equal protection. So this is not a question of whether we're going to retain the state's rights position on marriage. The country, as Lincoln said of slavery, will eventually go all one way or all the other. Either we will have same-sex marriage everywhere, effectuated through judicial decisions, ultimately by the Supreme Court perhaps, enforcing, say, a Massachusetts or New Jersey or Oregon same-sex marriage under the full faith and credit provision of the federal Constitution, or we will preserve the conjugal conception of marriage, which has been our historic understanding of marriage embodied in our laws. We'll preserve it in our laws throughout the nation by a constitutional amendment that would set a uniform national standard of marriage as the union of a man and a woman, while leaving decisions, rightly leaving decisions about such issues as the distribution of marital benefits to the individual states. So this is not a takeover of family law. Family law will remain largely in the hands of the states, but it will get the Constitution into setting a standard of marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Now, the people who make the argument that you're representing here for us, the people who make that argument sometimes add to it the claim that it is unprecedented for the federal government to get involved in the issue of marriage. It's always left to the individual states. Well, that's wrong historically. As a matter of fact, on the question of polygamy in the middle of the 19th century, the federal government intervened in a very strong and powerful way. In fact, Utah was forbidden from becoming a state except on condition that it constitutionally prohibited polygamy.
Now we're going to let him pick up that conversation and that subject. He is making a point about both state rights and the history of the debate over marriage in the United States. Dr. Robert George, we'll let him pick that up on the other side of the break, about 10 more minutes in our conversation. With Dr. Robert George, professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University and a member of the President's Council on Bioethics, reacting to the Senate's failure yesterday to pass the Marriage Protection Amendment. And then we'll get your reaction during some open lines in the second part of this first hour of Issues Etc. We are coming to you live this Thursday. It's the 8th of June. More with Robert George and open lines after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, senior editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ. And every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
Should women be given the facts before choosing abortion? The Florida Supreme Court says yes.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
A law requiring doctors to tell patients about abortion risks before performing the procedure won unanimous approval this spring from the Florida Supreme Court. The High Court interpreted the law to require that doctors discuss only medical matters, not economic, psychological, social, or religious issues. An attorney supporting the law says this was a common sense interpretation. Florida lawmakers don't expect doctors to be spiritual counselors or psychologists, but they do expect them to give their patients medical facts. The court's ruling will now ensure they do so.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Why did the early Christian church grow at a phenomenal pace? And why did those first disciples, those unschooled, ever-arguing disciples, stick to their story about Christ even to the point of death? Again, why did the first century non-Christian authors Pliny and Tacitus allude to something highly unusual happening after the crucifixion of Jesus? And one more. Why did opponents of the first Christians never dispute that Jesus' tomb was empty? Jewish stories claim Jesus hadn't really died. He was in a coma and then left the tomb. Others claim that Jesus' body had been stolen. What is never disputed is a report that the tomb was empty. Why did all these things happen? Shenanigans. That's the answer in the media era these days. To establish their power and privilege, the first Christians took a very human Jesus and spun him into the deity subsequent millennia have worshipped. Certainly, there was no such thing as a resurrection. Or so the new revealers of truth want us to believe. But those why questions linger, and the one answer to them all is that God surprised the world with hope by raising Jesus from the dead. I'm thinking about the resurrection, because on this date, June the 8th, in 632 A.D., the prophet Muhammad died. And he is still dead. Thanks for thinking. I'm Dale Meyer.
AMA 50 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AMA 50 KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. We're right in the middle of a conversation we had earlier today with Dr. Robert George of Princeton University and of the President's Bioethics Council, talking not about bioethics, but about the Senate's failure yesterday to pass the Marriage Protection Amendment. He has edited a new book called The Meaning of Marriage, and we'll pick up that conversation here in just a moment. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is right on the front edge of addressing these very kinds of issues. They're going to hold an Image of God conference. You've heard about one of those before, haven't you? This one on a Christian vision of love and marriage. They're doing it in conjunction with the Cranach Institute and Concordia Theological Seminary. It's going to be held September the 18th through the 20th. That's right at the fall. And fall's a great time to go up and visit Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. You get to see all students milling about, looking somewhat bewildered as they begin their classes. It's a beautiful campus to begin with. Remember, the Image of God conference on a Christian vision of love and marriage, September the 18th through the 20th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, you can call them, area code 260-452-2204, 260-452-2204. That's the Image of God conference at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can also visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu. Now, when we went to the break, we had to interrupt Dr. George in the middle of making a point. He first addressed the issue of states' rights. Why is this an issue that's being addressed, gay marriage, that is, at the federal level with the federal constitution and not being left to the states? His argument is, well, we didn't start the fight, and the fight was started in the judiciary, and the best way to respond to this judiciary, and by in the hands of an activist judiciary, where the gay marriage agenda is being pushed most actively, is to simply amend the Constitution. But he also wanted to take up the issue of how Americans had traditionally dealt with the issue of marriage and state rights. His example has to do with polygamy in the state of Utah. Here again, Dr. Robert George.
Now, the people who make the argument that you're representing here for us, the people who make that argument sometimes add to it the claim that it is unprecedented for the federal government to get involved in the issue of marriage. It's always left to the individual states. Well, that's wrong historically. As a matter of fact, on the question of polygamy in the middle of the 19th century, the federal government intervened in a very strong and powerful way. In fact, Utah was forbidden from becoming a state except on condition that it constitutionally prohibited polygamy. The Republican Party was founded on a platform in 1856 that pledged the party to fight against what the platform called the twin relics of barbarism. This was the party at the national level, the party of Lincoln. And the twin relics of barbarism against which the party pledged itself were slavery and polygamy. They wanted to reject the idea that human beings could be bought and sold, used up, controlled by other human beings, and they wanted to reject what they regarded, rightly in my view, as an assault on the institution of marriage and the family as properly understood. The Republicans today who are supporting the principle of conjugal marriage are very much in line with the tradition and history of their party on this issue.
Two quick final questions, Dr. George. Why are we debating marriage today, aside from the very, as you point out, very clever tactics of the proponents of gay marriage at the grassroots level? What is it about it in our society that allows this debate to take place in the first place?
That's an excellent question, Todd, and it really is not a matter of same-sex marriage. It goes much deeper than that, and in fact, I think that the demands for same-sex marriage and now for polygamy and polyamory are symptoms more than causes. They are what come in the train of an erosion of our understanding of marriage that began with the sexual revolution of the 1960s and the cultural rise of two very destructive phenomena. One was free and easy divorce. The idea that people should be able freely to get out of marriages whenever it didn't suit their purposes any longer to remain married, even on the unilateral initiative of one spouse over the objection of a spouse who did not want the divorce to happen. That's number one. Number two was cohabitation. It seemed so easy in the 1960s and early 70s to say, well, gosh, what does a piece of paper matter? What does a ceremony matter? What matters is that two people love each other. It doesn't matter whether they're married. Marriage is passé, and so forth and so on. It seemed easy at the time, and it seemed so right-thinking and progressive. It's turned out to be a disaster. Far from being a prelude to a true marriage and a strong family life, cohabitation, we now know, it tends to be a prelude to dissolution of the relationship, and if children are in the relationship, to the breaking apart of a family at the expense of children. So the erosion that came under the pressure of the rise of those phenomena has now manifested itself in demands for such things as same-sex marriage, polygamy, and polyamory.
Then with less than a minute, and finally, Dr. George, what is at stake if someone looks out on the debate that took place in the Senate? Of course, it will continue at the grassroots and then at this level, too. What is ultimately at stake here?
What's ultimately at stake is the well-being of children and families in the United States. Everything culturally, when it comes to marriage, depends on there being a strong marriage culture. And anything that tends to erode our understanding of marriage, anything that tends to erode the cultural support for marriage, will in the end harm families, and ultimately that means harming children. It also means harming society, because while government law depend on law-abiding citizens, good citizens, civically-minded citizens, citizens who are responsible, citizens who for the most part can take care of themselves and are not creating problems, rather they're solving problems, government and law cannot produce those citizens. It falls to the family to do that, and ultimately that means it depends on a stable and healthy culture of marriage. Now, the family needs the support of law and government, just as it needs the support of religious institutions and other institutions of civil society. But at the end of the day, it's the family, and that's why the state and law have a profound interest. There's a profound public interest in marriage. It's not merely a private relationship.
Dr. Robert George is professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University, a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. He has edited a new book called The Meaning of Marriage, Family, State, Market, and Morals. You can find out more about the meaning of marriage by calling Spence Publishing, 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB, or you can visit them on the web at www.spencepublishing.com. That's www.spencepublishing.com. Dr. George, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
You know, you'd have to listen to, I imagine, hours and hours of other Issues, Etc. guests on that subject, as good as they are, and they're all good, to get what you got in just about 20 minutes with Dr. Robert George there, pretty much covering the entire subject from top to bottom right in the midst of the national debate. Now, it will continue as a national debate. There's no two ways about it. This is not the last time. There's going to be an attempt to bring an amendment to the Constitution affecting the issue of marriage before the Senate. And, of course, the House is going to kind of go through the motions here. What do you think? Does this really matter to you? Does it matter? Are you disappointed that the Marriage Protection Amendment didn't even come close to getting what it needed, according to our constitutional system, to be put in the pipeline or to stay in the pipeline? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Your phone calls, your email for the next 20 minutes of Issues, Etc. Your reaction to the failure of the Marriage Protection Amendment to make it through the U.S. Senate. It was really a matter of being able to close debate, and they just couldn't close debate and get a vote on it. So what do you make of this? Is this just simply the way things are going to be on this issue? It'll have to be fought out in the states, state by state, and if you watch what's happened so far, that means it's going to be fought out with justices. One of the greatest points that Robert George made there, and I've heard him made it elsewhere in the media, is that, look, we're going to have an amended constitution one way or the other. It's either going to be amended by the people, or it's going to be amended by judges, by judicial fiat. And he even quoted Abraham Lincoln. It's going to go either one way, all one way, or all the other. Do you agree? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Maybe you'd like to react to or disagree with something that Robert George had to say. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's start with Sandra, who calls from Peavey. Hi, Sandra.
Good afternoon, Todd. Okay, I listened to the update with Dr. Dobson this morning on Focus, and the only question I have, I knew it didn't pass, but he was concerned, too, that it had enough votes in order to be brought up again, and I really haven't caught that with your discussion so far. They will be able to bring up the debate again?
It can be brought up again. There's not a problem with that. It actually got 49 votes against 48, but what it needed, of course, in the amendment process was, I believe, 61 votes, or 63 votes, I'm not exactly sure. They needed that supermajority in order first to close the debate and actually get a vote, and then the process calls for not just a simple majority of the Senate, but that supermajority of the Senate to approve an amendment to the Constitution. And that's still, even if it's brought up again tomorrow, that's still a long ways off, Sandra, just by counting heads.
Right, I understand, but just so that they would still be able to bring it back up, because they said if they got under a certain number of votes, they wouldn't even be able to bring it back up.
This amendment, perhaps not. I'm not sure about that, but there are other amendments in the pipeline, and there are other amendments that people out in the field are kind of proposing that are different from this one. In fact, some people believe a little simpler and a little stronger amendment would have been better than the one that was attempted through the Senate this last time. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Eric in Irving, Texas writes this: if the objective of the constitutional amendment is to, in the words of our guest Dr. Robert George, deliver a stinging rebuke to a judiciary usurping legislative authority, wouldn't impeachment of such judges be a more appropriate and effective means to that end? Well, on the individual basis, Eric, sure. I can't think of a stronger stinging rebuke to hand to an individual judge than, see you later, judge. You're no longer in office. Okay, in my less than expert viewpoint, however, I see some problems with that. Number one, is there the public will to impeach judges over this? We're really talking about politics being the art of the possible and politics being always taking the path of least resistance. That's the way things work in politics. Every idea follows the path of least resistance. I think the path of greater resistance in this case is probably getting people to individually impeach judges who've done something like this. Think about it this way. There are a fair amount of people who would say that in Massachusetts, the public will is against gay marriage by a very slim majority. But no judges have been impeached, even though through judicial fiat, Massachusetts has full-blown gay marriage. No judges have been impeached. Oh, people, I mean, you can threat, but you actually have to be able to do it in order for it to be that stinging rebuke. So, you know, given the fact that we're following the path of least resistance, which is all the more you can ask in politics, I imagine that's going to be the path of greater resistance than even amending the U.S. Constitution. The other thing about amending the U.S. Constitution is it fits all circumstances. It's the final word. You know, you can impeach a judge for acting like an activist from the bench. And then he's replaced by someone seven times more wicked than himself. It can happen. You can deal with that circumstance and every other circumstance by amending the U.S. Constitution. What do the rest of you think? Is it really worth a constitutional amendment? That's the big question I think most people are asking. The opponents of the constitutional amendment were saying during Senate debate, look, this is a big issue. We ought to argue about it. We ought to debate it. It's a good thing for us to talk about this, but amend the Constitution? That seems kind of drastic, doesn't it? What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. By the way, now a mere 45 minutes left in the Issues Etc. People's Choice Awards. You go to our website, issuesetc.org. You click Listen Online. You'll find a list of guests there from which we ask you to choose five. Email us with the link that's provided. Vote only once, but choose five of your favorite, your top guests. And then next week, while we're on vacation, we'll let the guests do the show. At least the best of their shows. We'll have the fifth top on Monday, the fourth top on Tuesday, the third top on Wednesday, the second top on Thursday, and then on Friday, next week on Issues Etc., your Issues Etc. top guest. You know what? I'm not going to tell you who they are. You will have to listen next week to find out. And if you want to affect the totals in any way, you'll have to go in the next 45 minutes to issuesetc.org, click Listen Online, and vote yourself. Voting ends 4:30 Central Time today. This story has been floating around in the world of cyberspace for a couple weeks, maybe a month. Finally made it to the Associated Press. Pat Robertson does and says many odd things, but perhaps one of the oddest lately, it's almost National Enquirer level kind of stuff. One of the oddest lately is his claim on his website, and you can go check it out for yourself. Just enter into any search engine, Robertson Leg Press. All three words, Robertson Leg Press. And you will find near the top there a link to Pat Robertson's website where he claims to have leg pressed 2,000 pounds. And you'll also find this, we'll play it for you here, with minimal commentary, a short video in which Pat Robertson actually does leg press, and this is still a feat, considering he's in his 70s and considering that NFL football players rarely do anything like this, where he does press, leg press, 1,000 pounds. He attributes it to his Pat Robertson age-defying shake. Here's that short video from Pat Robertson's website.
Now, Christy, I want to save the best to last.
Okay.
This is my wonderful leg press machine. I haven't been on this machine for a couple of months, and I wanted to show people, you know, you don't have to be 70 and go to a rocking chair. You see, I'm 74,
mm-hmm.
and you don't I mean, there's plenty of life left in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a light. I've got it set up, a real lightweight for you.
The bar, and you keep saying lightweight, but look how big these weights are.
The bar weighs 45 pounds, and those two plates were 40 each, so that's like 135 pounds. So for you, it'll be a piece of cake. So you sit down in this chair, put your legs, put your feet up there.
Okay.
Up in here somewhere.
All right.
You in there? All
yeah.
right. Now all you got to do is push.
What am I holding on to?
Just hold them.
All right.
All right, now push.
Do I put my feet here or here?
It doesn't matter.
Now what he's got her doing, he's got his lady friend there leg pressing 45 or 90 pounds.
Come on.
Okay.
I do 10 of them. Nothing to it. Isn't that good?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
You can't talk to me while I do this because I can't breathe.
All right, you remember in and out like I was showing you.
8, 9.
Okay. Wasn't that good?
Uh-huh.
All right, get off of there.
Okay.
Now, can I do something?
I'm just curious. How many pounds?
That's
about
550 pounds.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
He's starting with 550 pounds on the leg press. This is his warm-up.
You so put me to shame. That's all I have to say.
Now, guys, if you could put two more on either side, we'll take it up to 700.
That's too much.
He's talking about 45-pounders. That would make it another 90 pounds.
Even the camera guys are like...
8, 9, 10. Now, get some more weights.
No,
on.
No.
Oh, please, Christy, let me do some more.
Listen, I'm saying this.
Oh,
you have to do the show tomorrow.
I guess I'll take it up to 900 pounds. I'm so busy for you.
900 pounds.
That's only 900 pounds.
And perfect.
He's not done.
No. Pat Robertson.
Give me two more.
You are not going to go to 1,000.
Oh, yes, he is.
Listen, if Dee Dee Robertson calls me at home.
She'll love it. She'll send you a message and say, Christy, you really got the old man going. Give me two more 45.
Look. There's no more room.
No more room. This will be 1,000 pounds.
This is like an infomercial.
I just do a few of these, okay? Then you can try. You ready? Remember, Christy.
This is it.
I hope I can get it up there. Man, that's tough.
That's it. That's it. Okay, stop.
Oh.
He's actually doing 10 reps of 1,000 pounds.
8, 9, 10.
That's it.
All right, there you go. I mean... It was, 3 weeks ago I read about this on somebody's blog. I thought, well, I got to see this. I mean, Pat Robertson has said some strange things in his day, but feats of strength always interest the public. So, golly, I went and I watched and I said, there's Pat Robertson. Now, his form is not that good. If you've ever been in a weight room, he's got a regular leg press machine. It must be a hefty leg press machine. Some of the press surrounding this no pun intended, some of the press surrounding this when he first claimed to have done 2,000 pounds, they went and they talked to some NFL coaches. And the NFL coaches said 2,000 pounds, impossible. He claims to have done one rep, one single leg press lift of 2,000 pounds. That's not on the video, but the leg press, the 10 reps of 1,000 are there. A lot of the folks who were commenting on this in the world of sports said... I didn't even know there was a leg press machine that could hold 2,000 pounds. Now, there's a picture on his website of him on the leg press machine, fully extended, with weights and bars and free weights stacked on this thing practically to the ceiling to make 2,000 pounds. One rep, he says he did. Now, his form's not so good. He has his knees together, and then he's also pushing with his hands. Not on the press itself, but on his knees, which Jeff tells me, Jeff is Mr. Sports Aficionado. Jeff tells me is cheating. I'd like to see you do 1,000 pounds, Jeff. Cheating. Could you do it?
Give me that age-defying shape for a month, buddy. I'll have 2 tons.
He says he worked up to the 1,000 pounds over the course of some years, and he's just doing it, you know. He's Pat Robertson. Feats of strength. It is an amazing thing to see. It is. Now... This has made the press, and of course the AP eventually picked it up this morning. Let's hear from Pat Robertson himself. He said he really has leg pressed a ton.
I did it one time, one rep, but I had built up to it for about 3 years.
I mean, I'm a young man. I'm 42. I will occasionally go to the Y and, you know, goof off with the weights. I keep my weight very low because I'm aware of the fact that I'm going to injure myself at any moment. I could lift weights for 3 years, too. I'm half his age, practically, and I'm not going to get up to a ton. I can guarantee you that. And I am unusually strong for my size. Freakishly strong, they would say. Now, Pat Robertson says that he knows some people question whether he really accomplished this amazing feat of strength.
For some reason, this thing's been totally blown out of proportion. The answer is yes, one rep, I got 2,000 pounds up.
I'm amazed that his handlers and entourage permitted him to do this. I think he does it in his own private weight room. At any other gym, he probably would have lost his membership. You know, put some more on. Once you get 1,000 pounds on a leg press, you have maxed out the leg press. Then you have to start stacking free weights on, which is exactly what he did. He attributes it all to his age-defying shake. Old people don't have to give up lifting 1,000 pounds if they really want to. Robertson says that he lifted 2,000 pounds back in February of 2003.
I did do it, and I regularly could do 1,000 pounds and 1,200 pounds.
Well, I saw him do it. You heard him do it. It's amazing. In addition to being able to, and I'm not joking, I'm dead serious, in addition to being able to pray away hurricanes, it's another claim he's made, to speak for God when it comes to Dover, Pennsylvania, that if they're struck by a hurricane, God will not help them, and many other statements that he's made, in addition to all of that, feats of strength. When we come back from this break, hour two of Issues Etc. is straight ahead. We're going to be starting with another conversation with Dr. Robert Benny, who's author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Reasonable Ethics. We're going to talk to him about a basic Christian ethics. Then we'll spend the second part of that hour with Pastor Joel Brondos discussing classical education. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is going to be our guest in the last hour of the program. We need him around because yesterday we had an excellent conversation with John Dominic Crossan of the Jesus Seminar. Dr. Crossan denies the resurrection. He did it in many and various ways. And we'll get Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's reaction to some of the things that Crossan had to say yesterday with us in the third hour of Issues Etc. Today, we're coming to you live this Thursday. It's the 8th of June. When we come back, we'll be talking about an ethics that is based in a sound theology, not just to make it up as you go along, not just try and figure out exactly the do's and the don'ts, but what is the greater guiding principle for the Christian when it comes to living in the world ethically? We'll answer that question with Dr. Robert Benny after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.